This is Johnny Bluestar. Welcome to Threshold, a global media event. Is the universe just a random dance of atoms? Or is it a manifestation of a supremely intelligent architect? Can its purpose, or our purpose here on Earth, be adequately assessed? Can we commune with it, know its intentions, cooperate with its direction? Here, we define Threshold as a gateway state of awareness, allowing mankind to cross into a place of real cognition. Threshold allows us to approach questions of higher reality through the door of experience rather than mere belief. Welcome to Threshold, where we tear away the veil from commercial media, bringing our audience and participants into another realm of reality and enhanced communication. Welcome to Threshold. Today, we are going to be presenting components of an interview I conducted over a period of months with my friend and associate, Ray Boylan. I met Ray when I was chosen to help him out with a new level of edits for an autobiography called West Side Warrior. During this time, Ray and I also began to create a novel and film series called The Foot Soldier. The reason for this was that the memoir inspired me to help create a background for a largely fictional but fascinating storyline. I think I enjoyed almost every minute of working with this fantastic and dedicated Korean War veteran and crime fighter who grew up in the neighborhood that I was connected to when I lived in New York. In this interview, we were going to take a peek at childhood in the 1930s and 40s, the Korean War in the actual combat arena, and serious crime fighting in the following decades. Let's begin. Well, Ray, tell us a little bit about how you got involved with the Ramblers.
Well, in my neighborhood, there was five or six different gangs or football teams, whatever you want to call them. And the Ramblers were the most popular. At the time I moved in the neighborhood, I was only a young kid. So I didn't join any type of football team or gang. But the Ramblers had always been there. They were senior. And as a matter of fact, when World War II came, most of them were sent off to the war. However, then as they disseminated, the juniors take over. And that's what I was part of. They were in my neighborhood. It was a football team. And then we finally formed our own team called the Panthers. So all the teams, five or six and within the 15-block range, would play against each other on the football fields and Riverside Drive, and Central Park. Eventually, I became a member of the Ramblers, but not for long, about 6 months.
Tell us about the head of the Ramblers.
Well, head of the Ramblers during my time was Johnny Kerrigan, and he had a sidekick called Mikey Ryan. And Johnny Kerrigan's brother used to hang out with the Panthers.
Right.
Yeah. He was a nice guy.
But after that, someone else took over, right? When they were gone?
When I was gone, I really lost contact. I don't remember anybody telling me anything about the gang from New York.
Okay. You guys were called Dwarfs back then, right?
Oh, the Dwarfs, yeah. The Dwarfs was when I was very, very young. A guy named, Deuce.
Yeah.
Oh, formed about five or six of us, and called us the Dwarfs.
Deuce was part of the Ramblers, though, wasn't he?
He was, yes. Well, so was the Dwarfs. The Dwarfs were, it went like from seniors to juniors to Dwarfs to babies, same Ramblers.
So how old were you as a Dwarf?
Oh, maybe seven.
And what kind of things did they have you do?
Well, Deuce tried to make us do all kind of things, and I didn't trust him, so I pulled out.
How much resistance was there by the Ramblers who were losing your expertise as Dwarfs? They gave you a hard time.
What happened to seniors who I say went off to war used to hang out on the corner of 89 Columbus Avenue, and that's where I was living. And when they all disappeared or got married or went off to war, the Juniors, which was head by John Kerrigan, moved to 90th Street and Amsterdam Avenue, which was two blocks away from us.
Right.
The Bankers were on 96th Street, and the Irish Kings were on 84th Street.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they're pretty close.
So you didn't get too much flack from them when you formed your own team, or did you?
No, we didn't get, no, not too much.
So, you know, as you've expressed to me before, although you had the facade of playing football, you did other things too. You know, you mentioned a few of them, but what was the secret life of these club teams like?
Well, we caused a lot of havoc in the neighborhood. We'd sit on people's stoop and make a lot of noise, and they would, the tenants in the apartment house would chase us, and we would play stickball in the street, and the ball would hit their windows, and they'd call a cop, and then we'd hang out in the wintertime, we'd hang out in the hallways where they had radiators, and sit there, play games, word games. And of course, all the tenants tell us to leave, but we just made fun of them and stayed there.
Well, it seems like one of the things that you guys did that was kind of edgy, I would say, was your experience with this guy who owned a flower shop.
Oh, yeah.
I was on 89th Street, I believe.
Yeah, that was not good. There was a flower shop located actually on the corner of my building where I live. And we would play football in the street, touch football. And sometimes the football would hit his window, store window. And, of course, he got very upset at that. There came a time when the football bounced right into his shop, and he grabbed it and put it behind a shelf. So we all went to the entrance to the store, six of us. And one of the guys, Jimmy, went inside. And when he went inside to get the ball, the little shop owner came at him with a pair of flower snipping shears.
And pruning shears, right?
Pruning shears, yes. And he pushed them. Jimmy pushed the shop owner, and the shop owner fell over a bench. Of course, we got the ball, but a short time later, he had the cops come. And as soon as I saw the car stop on 89th Street and Columbus Avenue, I jumped into the candy store and went into a phone booth. What happened, unfortunately, the cop decided to take two of them, Richie and a guy named Willie, because the shop owner cut on his shin as they hit it as he went over the bench. And they went to night court that night. We all went down there to the criminal court building, and they got released to their parents. And then eventually, that was about the time I was getting ready to go in the Marines, or did leave for the Marines. And because they had no witnesses, and the shop owner stopped showing up at the court, they dismissed the case.
Oh, I see. Okay.
It was close.
But for a while, you guys were real worried.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
And so what would happen? What would have happened? What happened to kids who got in trouble during that era?
Well, because of their age, they would be sent, if they were convicted, to a juvenile home. And there were two of them that were popular. One was a state home, Warwick it was called, and the other was a Catholic home. And, of course, quite a few guys from the neighborhood served time there. But they said that the brothers at the Catholic home were tough, really tough, and that you were better off going to Warwick, where the state had control there. However, as I mentioned in my book, as you see a picture later on about such same type of schools, there was very bad incidents would happen with the guards and the young kids. So nobody they decided, well, we're not even going to go to Warwick.
Yeah. So one of the things you were mentioning about a Catholic detention home, but you went to some Catholic schools during your early years.
Yeah, I went to St. Gregory's for 8 years. But in the middle, my family moved downtown, so I went to St. Paul's for 1 year. And then my family moved back uptown to St. Gregory's.
But in St. Gregory's, you had a little problem with somebody. I believe her name was Sister Ignatius.
Ignatius.
Ignatius, excuse
yeah,
me.
Yeah, well, she decided that she, I wasn't going to graduate eventually. And she kept telling me, you're not going to be at the graduation, you're not going to graduate, and blah, blah. Even though I passed the state regents math and geography tests that they were giving out at that time, I got good marks. So I wasn't dumb, but I really didn't like school. And at that time, because of her, I started playing hooky, they call it, it's truancy. Became right. A truant. So when I got caught, the truant officer came to my home and said, you're not attending. My mother was there. Said, you're going to have to go to a hearing. So I went down to the hearing with my mother, and I know I was 15. And I kept telling the court officer, I'm going to go in the Navy. I'm going in the Navy, and I want to go to school. So, but he says, you're too young. You're only 15. So, yeah.
Big mistake, huh?
Yeah. So then my mother put me in Joan of Arc Junior High School, which is on 94th Street between Amsterdam and Columbus Avenue.
Mm-hmm.
And I was put in a fast class because of my Rhesus marks, but I couldn't keep up and didn't want to keep up. So by the time I hit the ninth grade, I was put in a slow class. And in the slow class, there was all these really rough guys. They had to come in from the Bronx. And I think
the Dragons, right?
The Dragons, yes. Uh-huh. And, but I was able to make up to them and get friends with them.
Yeah, so like I think in the beginning, they wouldn't even let you eat lunch, right?
Yeah, I went to sit down with them, maybe four of them were at a table. And they said, who are you? And we don't want you here. Get out of here. I says, look, all I want to do is have my lunch and get out of here. And he says, I'll knock your lunch on the ground. You'll have to eat it from the ground. So I said, I try to be nice to them and very nice. And they finally came around.
That's good. What do you think is the difference? I mean, when you look at kids today and our lives today, what would you say is the difference between when you were younger, like 7, 10 years old, this sort of thing, and kids today? Are they having any kind of the same experiences, or how would you characterize it?
I don't think we were very mild compared to the gangs of today, and we respected life, and today's mm-hmm. gangs, they don't respect life. They have initiations where the initiation is to go out and kill somebody or hit him on the jaw or bop him on the head with a wrench. That's going too far, but they don't have no respect for life today.
What about the ordinary kids who are not really gang members? Do you think there's much of a difference between your time in the 40s, 30s, and happening now?
I think the ordinary ones are the more intelligent ones that study and whose parents have control over them, keep them from joining gangs or getting involved with the wrong company. And they study harder and they're more intelligent, I think. And they go on to become computer technicians. I don't know if we could have did that.
So maybe in some ways for a certain group of people, it's for children, certain group of children, they maybe have it a little bit better off in a way.
I would say so, yes, they're better off.
But do they have as much fun?
I really don't think so.
A lot of their fun is virtual. It's on a machine, a computer or game machine.
Yeah.
Whereas your fun was real tangible. I mean, jumping from roof to roof and scooting around.
Yeah, I don't think they hang out on the street, on the corners. Yeah. Or, I mean, my neighborhood, there was at least 100 boys. So there was always 10, 15 guys on a corner. You don't see that today.
Well, listen, Ray, it's a real pleasure going over some of this stuff about your childhood. I'm a little bit younger than you, but I lived very close to where you lived. I was at 102nd Street on Riverside Drive. So every time I look at your book and talk about it, I have my own fond recollections, but they weren't anywhere near as exciting as yours.
No. I guess not. Well, I had no father, and I was raised by my grandmother, so I was loose.
Right. Yeah, I lived with my grandparents there with my parents because when my father got out of the Army.
Yeah.
And it was I remember Riverside Park real well. I loved it.
Yeah.
But it wasn't really, I was too young to join a gang. You know, I was like five or something like that.
Well, they used to hold square dances up there by 100th Street and Riverside. We used to go to the square dances. But you had to always be careful who you bumped into, because the other gangs would go to the square dances too.
I see. You had to be careful.
Yes.
We begin our break with a clip of a song called My Heart Is Ready, sung by Patricia Welch and composed by Edgar Ahrens, and with lyrics that I wrote for an album we are working on called Hadley's Castle. Next part of the interview, Ray discusses some of the mischievous incidents in his childhood, and then I asked him about how he got wounded in combat.
Tell us about the great newspaper scam.
Yeah, that was fun. Want me to tell you about it?
Yeah, please.
Well, it was during the war, maybe 1944, 45, and the Daily News of New York went on strike. I think it was a time when American forces were invading North Africa, and everybody was cramming for news. So Richie, my best friend and head of the Panthers, decided we go to his basement, because he was superintendent, or his family was superintendent of the building, and they saved all kind of newspapers. And we dug out a whole bunch of old Daily Newses, maybe some a week old, about a week old, most of them. And we got into the street, and we started to sell them, as because people, like I say, were cramming for news, because the news Daily News was on strike. So as we passed people on the street, we'd sell them a paper. And it probably was, like I say, at least more than a week old. And then we went down to stand near the subways, the entrance to the subway, the one on 96th Street. And we sold them as people were coming home from work, really. It was around 4 or 5 o'clock. And eventually, there was a cop that was stationed in my neighborhood. His beat was 89th Street, Columbus Avenue, and 10 blocks thereof. And he, all of a sudden, showed up at the subway entrance where we were selling the papers. So he was in plain clothes, though. So he said, "Hey, you guys, come here." He says, "I live in the neighborhood. What do you got there?" So we eventually had to tell them our story. However, we were able to make a break and run home to 89th Street and hide in Richie's basement.
But he was looking for you, right?
Oh, yeah. He was always on the alert for us.
Well, you know, I was thinking about those times back then during the war. And, of course, you were really, really young. But there was one of the things that happened during this time, which it wasn't really because of the war, but it was during the war, I believe, was when the Empire State Building was hit by an aircraft. Do you recall that?
Oh, yes, I recall it. You'll see a picture of the crash site. I think it was the 76th floor in my book from the newspapers. And when that happened, of course, we all got on the subway and went down to 34th Street. That's where the Empire State's located, and picked up whatever we could on the ground.
So where we could, did you see all the smoke and all that, the damage?
Yeah, it was still smoking when we were down there the same day. However, eventually, of course, the firemen must have got it out.
So it was a pretty big deal, though, right?
Oh, yeah. All the whole New York was really upset and couldn't believe it happened.
Do you recall why it happened? Do you recall the reason that he crashed?
They crashed because they were supposed to land in New Jersey, and they got lost. And there was weather, probably cloud.
Oh, I see.
It was an Army Mitchell, I think, aircraft, and hit the building. They didn't see it.
It was actually like it was a B-25 bomber.
Oh, okay, B-25, right.
It's pretty amazing. Yeah. There was a lot of colorful things that kind of happened during that period of time. Like there was a big fire on the SS Normandy, right?
Yeah, the SS Normandy was docked on the Hudson River, one of the piers, and it was being converted from, I guess, a passenger liner to a troop carrier.
Uh-huh.
And one day it caught fire and eventually rolled over on its side. So, we went down there and saw it laying there, too. But the reasons why the fire started are still not solved today. They think it was from an accelerant torch, and then they think it was the longshoremen who did it on purpose to show that they wanted work or whatever the reason. And then they thought it was espionage, sabotage.
Because you had a bunch of spies that landed on Long Island Beach, right?
Well, there was a, I don't know if that was at the same time, but yes, there were about five Nazis that came in to Long Island Beach at Amagansett in a submarine. And they were out there trying to cause problems with the store owners, with the Jewish population. But in Amagansett, there was a lot of Germans, and these guys hung out there and drank at all the bars in the area. However, one of them finally decided he had enough and he wanted to give up and get into a U.S. prison. And he turned all the others in, so they all were captured. Whether or not they got into Manhattan to do something to the Normandy, I don't know.
Well, another thing, I remember, of course, you and we talked about it briefly, were the air raids. So were there a lot of those air raids at the time during the war?
I mean, oh, yeah. We used to have an air raid maybe three times a week. And then we had what they call air raid wardens. They were civilian volunteers that would go around and police the neighborhoods and make sure all the lights are out and the apartments are closed off or with the lights out or closed off with curtains so you couldn't see light. Of course, we had a little trick we did. I found a tool that fit the lamppost light device. So a couple of times, I'm not going to say every time we had an air raid, but a couple of times, we would go down and put the street light back on and then run like hell. Of course, the air raid wardens, they had whistles. They would be blowing their whistles at us, but we'd be running fast and as you get away from the light, it got pitch dark. So we could easily hide from the air raid wardens.
One thing that when I was researching this book, and actually I was looking for pictures for the cover, I learned about parkour, which is a sport where you jump off buildings and stuff like that. Now, you guys were doing stuff, you were jumping off from one building to another all the way back in the 1940s.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't really understand that. Did you really jump from, how dangerous was it to jump from six-story?
It was from 4 to 6 floors high with an alleyway. And there would be each alleyway was. It would jump from one edge to the other, across. I guess it was 5 feet.
It's pretty dangerous, isn't it? I mean, were people hurt?
Well, nobody got, no, not during my time. And nobody ever fell. We got so good at it.
That's a nice little broad jump, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. I'm saying 5 feet because alleyways have to be about 5 feet for firemen to get in there, I guess. I don't know.
Are you actually standing on a ledge or are you having a running jump?
No running jump. We stand on the ledge.
I'm glad I was born a little bit later.
There were about three or four alleyways from 89th. Eventually, I moved to 88th Street. So there were about three or four alleyways I had to jump when I would go across the roof to go home.
Were you ever scared? I mean, you were often running away from people when you were jumping. What was it like? I mean, what was it as a kid?
Let me tell you, it was exciting, very adventurous. But we always made the jump. And one time I can say during the winter, there was ice on one side, and I was kind of leery. But I did it anyway, and I did slip, but I slipped forward onto the roof.
Whoa.
That was taking a chance.
Well, another thing that you used to do a lot was you used to fool around with these scooters. Tell us about what these scooters were like.
These scooters were great. In my book, I quote them as saying they were my magic carpet to get around the neighborhoods. We would get an orange crate, a wooden orange crate, and then get a 2x4 and cut it down to a certain amount of length. And then we'd take a roller skate, split the roller skate in half, and nail the back end to the back end of the 2x4 and the front end to the front end. And we would go all over the neighborhood. It was like my favorite little toy, the best thing I ever had. It got me from 72nd Street to 96th Street.
Wow. So this is years and years before skateboards and all that other stuff came out, but it was really quite like it, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was the same thing, really, going through the streets.
Did you use handles on it? I mean, were you standing up with a handle, or was it without a handle?
No, you could do it without handles, but we would take like a 2-inch piece and cut it to about 5 inches. I put one on a slant on the left hand and one on a slant on the right hand. And that would be our handles.
Another thing that you guys used to do is you used to go to like a park and you used to have, I think it was the Soldiers and Sailors Monument, 89th Street and Riverside Drive, right in your neighborhood.
Yeah.
And didn't you have some kind of a game there?
Well, whenever two gangs got in conflict, and decided that they were going to have a fight, they would go to the Soldiers and Sailors Monument, and that's where they all would meet. And as I say in my book, there never was a real gang fight. We were all 10, 12 guys were hitting each other. We used to pick out the best fighter from each gang, and they would they would shoot it off. And, of course, our best fighter was Richie. My friend, he was picked, and of course, I say in my book too, unfortunately, every time he was in a fight, and he was in a lot of them, broke his hand.
Wow. So Richie was like pretty much of an innovator. I mean, he was the one who actually formed the Panthers.
Yes, he was leader, captain of the team, and he was good. He excelled at all kinds of sports.
Tell us how the team actually started and why it started. Why did you guys undwarf yourself, so to speak, from the Ramblers?
Oh, yeah. Well, we decided we had enough guys living on the block to form a team. We solicited them to join up with us and become the Panthers. And then we would play against the 5 or 6 teams within the 10-block radius. The teams... the Irish Kings and the Bankers and the Ramblers too, and the Wildcats.
What about when they actually got hit? I guess you were hit by shrapnel, right?
A ricochet from a bullet-fired sniper in a cave. It hit me in the face. I didn't know how bad it was, so I fell to the ground and put my hand there where I was stinging and had a lot of blood. So I know I got hit. And a few medics that were in the area, they pulled this sliver of the bullet right out of my cheek and put a bandage on.
So did that change your attitude a bit, though? I mean, or did you still feel fairly immune to being hurt?
Well, it didn't change my attitude. The corpsman had ordered me to the rear to get penicillin when you get a piece of lead in you. But my lieutenant said he needed me to take this one hill because we had lost a section of our squad. Yeah. And we're short of men, so I agreed to go forward. I wasn't afraid. I just decided I'd go forward and help them out.
Okay, so let's fast forward to when you were actually there fighting the Chinese. And you're in foxholes, and bullets just coming everywhere.
Yeah.
Did you still feel a sort of faith in that you would make it?
No, I wasn't sure then because there was an awful lot of gunfire going on, and it was very dangerous situations where the bullets are sometimes hitting at your toes or your heels and going over your head. I figured, my God, this is for real, and I got to get cover. So I was with one guy, a good man, and Bob Custance was a former Marine in the Pacific Island, because the company I was with was mostly reserves. And they were all called up there in August, and I joined up with them in Japan in September. So I was with a seasoned troop, and he guided me, told me when to jump down and get in a hole or get out of here, let's go. I'm glad I had him, and I was lucky to get out of there.
Did you find yourself... We've never really discussed this in any detail, but did you find yourself praying or thinking about spiritual things during this time?
Well, always pray to God to be here tomorrow. But also, I had an imagination about everybody that died became a star in the sky. Right. So it was my thought that if all my friends are up there, and maybe I will be too someday. And that was my extent of my spirit.
How did the guys in the field, when you were sitting around talking at night or whenever you had a chance, what did they talk about? Did they always talk about combat? Were they talk about their families? Or what kind of conversations took place?
Well, we never talked about combat. Unless it was like yesterday I saw my buddy get killed or get shot. And mostly we would talk about rumors that were coming out all the time. Like, for instance, up in the north, there was a rumor we were going to be home for Christmas. Just rumors mostly.
I see. Okay. I've worked with Russian composer Edgar Aaron for quite a few years, building an inventory of songs, many of which feature singer-performer Patricia Welch. We will soon be releasing these songs, components of an album and a musical in progress called Hadley's Castle. When Edgar and I first got together, I was amazed by the brilliance of his musical scores created for movies, TVs, and animations. Here is a sample of the work he did on the Russian TV series, available now on Amazon, called The Secret Agent's Memoir, which had 2 seasons. This score is called Escape and was created for the first season. I am very pleased to say that Bridge of Light Productions, a division of New Galaxy Enterprises, is proud to be the contact point for television and film companies seeking information about this amazing composer's work. If you're in the entertainment business and wish to know more, contact me at johnnybluestar@gmail.com. That's johnnybluestar@gmail.com.
This is Johnny Bluestar. We were returning to an interview I recorded with Ray Boylan. In this segment, Ray tells us how after his first taste of combat, he was wounded and was temporarily assigned to a ship for treatment. He then made an interesting discovery, which I asked him about.
While you were on the ship, something came up about the about your medals, right?
Yeah, about a Purple Heart.
Yeah, why don't you tell that story?
Well, I was, I had got an abscess in my tooth, so I went down to the dental to get it pulled. And while I was under Novocaine, waiting for the Novocaine to take place, one of my sergeants said to me, "Ray, I hear you got a Purple Heart." And I said, "No, I didn't get no Purple Heart. I only got a sliver in my jaw." He says, "Well, yes, somebody signed for your Purple Heart. Why don't you go see the first sergeant?" So after I had my tooth pulled, I went down to see the first sergeant, and it's one of those little clerical busyness going on. So I finally found the first sergeant. I said, "Look, Sergeant, somebody told me I got a Purple Heart. I didn't get any Purple Heart, and I don't think I really should have a Purple Heart." He says, what'd you do, lose it, Boylan? I said, "No, I never got it." So all of a sudden, a lieutenant, the mortar lieutenant, came into the compartment where all the clerical was going on. And I said, "Well, that's the lieutenant that said he gave it. He gave Purple Hearts out." So the first sergeant said to him, "Lieutenant, did you give out 28 Purple Hearts one day up in the hill?" He says, "Yes, but half the guys didn't show up because they were cut off by enemy fire." So he just signed the list for 28 guys to receive the medal. Of course, when I got home, I eventually got the medal.
Well, one of the questions I've had, and I think a lot of people would be interested, I mean, you were a kid from New York, and, you know, you were in a gang, but you weren't really involved in combat until you got into Korea, right?
Yes.
I mean, you saw some gang stuff happen and maybe some bad stuff, but you didn't see people just killed and you weren't trying to protect yourself with a gun every few seconds. What was it like to experience combat for the first time?
Well, I had a unique feeling. When I departed the ship we were on, went down a cargo net and landed at the Incheon port, everything to me seemed to be still at the maneuvers. Since I was in the Marines in 1948, and we used to go on maneuvers two times a year, and it was all kind of repetition to the maneuvers, going down the cargo net, going in by landing barge, landing on the beach, and going forward. Of course, I began to realize that there were snipers around. The beach wasn't really secured. So one of my friends, or a guy who was a boxer, got shot in the head. And I said, "Oh, this seems like it's for real."
I'll bet.
So as we started to walk towards Seoul, we passed by Kimpo Airport, where there must have been a bloody battle a day or so before. And the poor attempt to cover up the dead North Korean soldiers kind of exposed their faces and their hands and their legs. And I said to myself, "Well, they're dead bodies, and this is for real."
And then there was the time that you saw the Chinese soldier on the bridge, right?
Oh, no, he was in North Korea.
That was North Korea?
Yeah, that was in North Korea when the second day of walking towards Seoul, I could hear a lot of fire going on up ahead. So we all kind of tried to take cover, and I dropped down into a small gorge and spotted this North Korean soldier waiting for some of my team members to walk across the bridge. He was in a good position to get every one of them. And I saw him, and he didn't see me. So, of course, I took aim, and I kind of hesitated because I figured, well, I'm going to kill this guy, and it'd be the first one I ever killed. But I figured, well, I'm saving my teammates. So I fired three shots, and they exploded in his body, and he dropped. He died. He was already down on the ground. He died.
Was it kind of a shock to you, or how did you feel?
Oh, yeah. I figured just thoughts went through my head. Gee, if this happens, how come you don't get punished killing somebody?
Yeah.
But then I realized, well, look, this is war, him or I. That was it.
Yeah, him or you or your friends, right?
Oh, yeah, my soul members.
Yeah. So did you ever get used to it? Because later on, there was a lot of combat, right, when the Chinese invaded?
I kind of got immune. Yes, I got immune to it. Where there was a lot of a lot of times we hit a bunch of shooting going on and firing back at us, and all I could think about is I got to keep my head down. I fired back quite a bit, but I can't say I ever hit anybody for sure.
But there were times when you were in a combat situation for days at a time, correct?
Always trying to go forward and getting pinned down on a road and chasing them out of there. They were retreating at that time.
Well, when you were in Chosin and you were fighting the Chinese, it was very, very cold, right?
Oh, yes. They say it was 30 below.
And how did you fare fighting in that kind of circumstance?
I don't know. I was freezing all the time, and especially at nighttime when we stopped to dig a hole, which we hardly could dig in the frozen ground. But I was always cold, and I never did like the cold. And
did you get sick during that time, or?
I didn't get sick. No, I was lucky. I had a nice sleeping bag.
Oh, well, that's good.
But one time a corpsman came by. This was after the Chosin Reservoir. We were evacuating or tacking in a different direction because Chinese had sent 200,000 troops across the Yellow River to annihilate the 1st Marine Division and kill the morale of the army that was fighting in Korea. So a corpsman came by and he stepped on our feet if we had frostbite. And if you didn't feel it, I think I had real frozen feet. He put you in a truck. So I got into a truck and we were starting to go down the hill. It was a 14-mile road, only one road down, and lots of roadblocks and lots of shooting going on in the hills by Chinese snipers. And then all of a sudden, truck hit a bump or something and went off the road, and I rolled over with the truck. And when I got out, I fell again right into the icy water. I really sprained my back, whatever it was. As you read the book, I had a previous back injury in Camp Lejeune. I really couldn't walk with a pack on my back. So they put me back in another truck, and we headed downhill until the guys in front of us knocked out all the roadblocks, and we finally hit our support troops to the rear, came up to join them, not hit them, come up to join them.
Yeah. So basically, Ray, these memories that you have, they seem so vivid. I mean, so you never really forgot those moments of combat and sort of adventure and career, correct?
No, I can tell you I remember almost every day.
Yeah.
Because when we were evacuating, I was in a truck, and we were attacking in a different direction, is what the general said. And I was in a truck freezing, and I really wasn't involved in the shooting anymore. And I finally got down to the safe ground, and they put me in a jeep and sent me to an airport to get ready to go to Japan.
I'll bet despite the fact you had a lot of excitement, you were kind of relieved to get out of there, weren't you?
Oh, yeah. I was looking out the airplane. I said, boy, I'm glad I'm leaving that country behind.
Yeah. You know, I was thinking about your story, and one of the more interesting, dangerous parts was the time that you guys went over after a sniper in Korea. And I thought maybe you could tell the story about that sniper a little bit.
Well, the sniper was in a cave outside the hills of Seoul, and we were trying to get up a road, and he was picking off guys as they came by. I was moving along. Some guy said, you better move faster. But I really didn't pay any attention. And all of a sudden, a sniper fired. And fortunately, his bullet hit a rock. And slivers of the bullet went flying. And I got a piece in my jaw. Then the medics came over. The medic that was there for the mine clearing. And he put a bandage on it. And I continued to go forward. That the one you mean, Johnny?
Yeah, that's the beginning of it. But what about how you got everyone got the sniper?
Oh, you mean? Oh, that's another one. That's the guy with the burp gun. When we continued to go forward and go and take the hill that we were ordered to do, we got pinned down right at the crest by a guy up a tree behind us who had a burp gun. And he was spraying the crest of the... Luckily, I stopped 10 feet before the crest. And because I didn't see nobody coming up on my left or coming up on my right. So I said, I better slow up. And a guy named a Marine named Taylor, who was a sailor during the war, ran past me, dropped down on the crest, and started firing at fleeing North Koreans. Just about that time, this fellow up the tree let go with a spray of burp gun bullets, and he got hit in the shin, jumped about 5 feet high. What's the heck? Then he hit again in the arm. So I pulled him down. I told him to come down. I helped him down maybe 10, 15 feet, and I bandaged his leg. That was bleeding the most. His arm was like a flesh wound, and he wasn't looking too good at that time, but it took about 2 hours of us laying there to let Sniper decide to get out of that tree and try to escape. So when I figured all the shooting was over in that area for the time, I was helping Sailor down the hill.
Right.
Get him back to an aid station. And in the meantime, we ran into a batch of Marines from George Company. I was in Item Company. I was going to take this hill on Item Company. And they were across the road. But they decided to come over because that Sniper bothered them. And what would happen is we would fire down into the trees where the Sniper should have been. And our bullets was going down as far as the road and entering a hut. And in the hut, we had wounded George Company members mostly. And some of them bullets were hitting the wounded. So George Company Marines got kind of upset about that, and they came across the road, and somehow they found out that this Sniper was in a Korean hut. So as I bumped into them going down the road, they told me he was in there somewhere. So I turned the Sailor over to one of them guys to hold him for a while, and I went over and I threw two grenades into that hut, and of course a big boom and lots of dust and wood flying. Two civilians came out. The lady, a man and a woman, the lady had a wound in her mouth, and that's all. But they were telling us that the Sniper is underneath the floorboards. Well, I couldn't do anything more. I wanted to get Taylor down to the aid station, so I took off. Later, I heard that George Company caught the guy and executed him.
I see.
Yeah, they hung him. So that was that Sniper.
What was the, I wanted to ask you, at that point you were wounded already, right?
Yeah, I had a hole in my cheek with this white bandage on, and I figured I better not stay along here. This is too being able to spot. So when I got Sailor to the aid people, they asked me what happened. I told them, I said, some guy, one of the minesweeping first aid guys, Corman, pulled a piece of metal out of my jaw. They said, well, you got to go back and get penicillin.
Yeah.
So he gave me a shot of morphine, and I got in the Jeep, and one of the stretchers of the Jeep, and eventually back to the 121st Evacuation Army Hospital.
Well, before you went into that, before you caught the Sniper, and you were wounded already, and you were asked if you could stay even if you were wounded, right?
Yes, my lieutenant... The corpsman, the minesweeper corpsman told the lieutenant that I should go back, get penicillin. And my lieutenant said, Ray, right now we need you for a while. Later you can go back because we were losing our men along the road because the fellow that shot at me up in the cave was knocking off guys at our squad. So
yeah.
He needed all the personnel he could take, and I said, okay, I'll go forward up the hill with you.
Well, so it worked out pretty well for him, but maybe not for the Sniper, huh?
No, not for the Sniper at all.
Well, one of the things is when you finally got some help, you got to get your penicillin, and you were put on a ship, right? And isn't that right?
Yeah, after I got released from the hospital, I rejoined my outfit. It took me 3 days to get to them and 3 nights.
Here is another song written by Edgar Ahrens and myself and sung by Patricia Welch. It's called Love Never Withers.
Makes me shiver. Its gray shrieks make me following is from West Side Warrior, the memoir of Ray Boylan, a Korean War veteran and crime fighter. He was there fighting in the world's coldest battlefield when the Chinese communists invaded.
Desperate squad members ran past our foxhole yelling, "Get the hell out of here! There's too many of them!" Again, we saw the Chinese soldiers charging in with opium-induced mindlessness, oblivious of our bullets. Again, we heard the bugles and whistles. Climbing out of our foxhole, Bob dropped two hand grenades behind us, and I threw one over my shoulder. Bullets whizzing by our heads, Bob and I became bolts of lightning flashing across the mountainside. Like a hideous film, desperate scenes like this played out on the Tokong Pass for 3 days. Sometimes I played in the scene. Sometimes I could only watch and wonder if it were real, or if I'd be suddenly jolted out of my trance by an RKO usher saying, "Hey, did you kids sneak in here?"
To acquire this book, Google westsidewarrior.boylan.kindle. Boylan is spelled B-O-Y-L-A-N. That's West Side Warrior, Boylan, Kindle.
Patricia has been busy creating a super enjoyable collection of classic standards in an exciting 46-song, 3-CD collection.
Music for Great Entertaining introduces Cocktails, Dinner, and Dessert with Patricia Welch. 3 hours of continuous music. 46 of the all-time classic standards, spanning decades of hit songs. Going to a friend's home for dinner? Cocktails, Dinner, and Dessert with Patricia also makes the perfect hostess gift. This 3-CD compilation is the perfect background music that sets just the right mood for any dinner party.
I'm crazy for feeling so lonely. There was a boy, a very strange, enchanted boy.
To purchase this album, just go to patriciawelch.com/CD. That is patriciawelch.com/CD. You won't be disappointed. Ray and I have now worked together for many years and have gotten to know each other during all kinds of changes in our lives. I've developed a tremendous respect for Ray, what he did with his life, and the honorable way he conducted himself during his service and his continuing role as a crime fighter. During the end of his career as an active crime fighter, he served as the head of security for Barnard College, one of the leading women's colleges in America. Again, just like I shared Ray's neighborhood when I was younger, I also went to Columbia around the time of his service. Columbia University is adjacent to Barnard in and around Morningside Heights, which was not always a safe neighborhood then, but also disrupted at the time by student strikes and discord.